Good morning, world diners and travelers. Once again, you're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. And good morning to Peter Haig.
Yeah, good morning. And if you weren't planning on listening to On the Menu Radio, we suggest you stay. But if not, go to whatever destination you really intended to go to. We're just happy to be here with all of our regular listeners, and we hope there are some new listeners out there too, and that you'll enjoy joining the On the Menu family.
Now, you know, I was just nibbling on this next product. It's kangaroo products, and I just love these. We discovered these at our son's home in South Carolina, and we immediately got a hold of the company called Kangaroo Brands, and turned out that it's an interesting story as well.
On the Menu's found another terrific product. What luck we had when we encountered Kangaroo Brands pita chips. And we have now George Cashew, who he says is pronounced just like the nut, who is the founder of this brand and CEO, I'm assuming. Hello, George.
How are you all?
Well, we're fine. I was telling you off air that you have a whole new audience just in our little club, because everybody's rushing around trying to find these wonderful pita chips. Explain how you got started in this business, because it's an interesting story.
We grew up eating pita bread as little kids, and my brother and I are really the founders of the company, and we've worked together for the last 30 years, and we noticed that there was not a great quality pita bread out there that could be enjoyed by the American. And the main feature, as we saw it, was the pocket in pocket pita. So we set out to produce a very high-quality product, and we chose a brand name that was descriptive of its main feature, the pocket.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, we lived in Australia. We love kangaroos. Did you see we have kangaroos on our website?
Yes, I did. That's very cute. They're cuddly, lovable animals.
You can borrow those if you want it for your advertising.
But you're sort of like a cereal bread maker, right? I mean, you didn't start out with pita. You started out with something else.
Well, we actually started the business just making pita breads. I personally, while I was in school, ran the first bagel bakery, so I had some background, and I loved the baking. And that didn't help me a great deal, because my brother was really the engineering genius that figured out and engineered a production system that would make a really consistent, high-quality product.
How is that?
I'm the sales marketing guy in the company.
Great. Now, do you actually still make and sell pita bread as a fresh product?
Oh, absolutely.
Okay.
We ship our pita bread actually frozen all over the country.
Huh.
Under the Kangaroo brand, and it is thawed when it's displayed at, you know, for retail sale.
Where is it in retail?
Oh, you can find it at Walmart Supercenters, most Walmart Supercenters around the country. Kroger stores have it. Public and select local and regional chains throughout the country carry our product, from ShopRite in New York, to Price Chopper in Albany, to St. Louis, everywhere.
Now, are the pita chips made from actually whole pita breads, or are you now customizing the shape?
What we found as we delved into the pita chip business about 3 years ago was that most people were making pita chips using traditional pita breads that they would buy from local or regional bakeries, and they would reprocess them into chips. They would take, you know, 2-, 3-, 4-day old bread, and they would cut it up, and they would dry it out.
And that's like bagel chips, yeah.
Right. And we know that the best way to make a pita chip is to start with fresh pita. We make fresh pita bread as it comes out of the oven. We immediately cut it, and we toast it. We don't just dry it out. We actually toast it first, removing all the moisture and giving it... Excuse me. I have a frog in my throat this morning.
Yes, I do too.
And we give it a really nice flavor. And after it is toasted, we immediately season it with sunflower oil and sea salt and various seasonings.
You see, it's also fairly healthy, isn't it?
Yes, it is. It's a lower sodium.
Lower and healthy fats. Yeah.
And the sunflower oil is really a very heart-healthy sunflower oil.
Right. Now, get a glass of water, George.
I'm okay now.
Listen, tell us what the flavors are.
We make a sea salt. We make a multigrain with sesame and flaxseed and oak bran.
That's healthy.
Really good. And we spice that with a blend of garden spices, all natural. All our products are all natural. And we also make a cinnamon sugar. And I don't know if you know this or many of your listeners know this, but cinnamon is one of the healthiest spices you can
use. Yes, it is.
It is wonderful.
Right.
I've heard many, many stories of people who are diabetic who actually control their blood sugar by eating cinnamon and have actually gotten off medication.
Yes, I have heard stories.
Oh, that's amazing. We should send some to my brother.
Yeah. But no, it's blood pressure control. It's all kinds of wonderful things. It's botanical with health benefits as well as tasting good. We also encountered a healthy beverage made of ginger, comes out of West Africa.
Oh yeah, ginger and pita chips together is just about a total diet.
Yeah, ginger is a real miracle cure-all for a lot of things.
But George, there's actually when Peter was joking about this pita diet, there's now this pocket diet which features pita bread.
Right.
It's a whole established new diet trend, right?
I wrote the pocket diet.
Oh, you did do that.
That's my book. I authored it.
Oh.
Well,
I didn't know that. A little bit
of self-serving stuff in there, George, maybe?
Absolutely.
It's called the only pita pocket fit to eat is a kangaroo brand.
And I'll tell you why.
Okay.
And consumers who eat pita bread will also confirm what I tell you. Portion control, first of all, on a dieting,
exactly.
From a dieting perspective, is really the best way to control your weight for life. And I came up with the idea of the pocket diet and portion control at the height of the low-carb diet.
You're wonderful.
So much confusion about proper nutrition that I one day woke up and said, you know, don't people understand that eating a well-balanced diet, but eating good, the right portions and, you know, being active is really the only long-term solution. There is no magic bullet. There's no magic diet out there. And I took the idea to a hospital, a well-known hospital in Wisconsin, and their dietitians thought that it was brilliant. They proceeded to do a 38 diet study where we gave them basic recipes and foods to eat, common everyday foods. But we told them, eat 1 to 2 pockets in the morning with your favorite food. Eat 2 in the afternoon. And at dinner, eat a sensible dinner or put your sloppy joes or whatever favorite food you have in a pocket.
The key
is learn to control your portion. It was extremely successful. People who've never lost weight on other diets lost weight. The average weight loss was, I believe, 11 pounds or 15 pounds in 6 weeks. And it was the most sustainable, easy diet that people, this is what we heard, that it was the easiest diet to follow because there was no special needs or cooking and the whole family could enjoy it.
Well, you know, it's all over the internet. I mean, you fought back against the Atkins stuff.
That's exactly what I was looking to do. I was looking to educate people on proper nutrition.
You're a genius, George. You're an amazing man.
And it was, and to your point, was it self-serving? In a way it was, but
it
in
works.
Another way, it really wasn't.
George, I was just really kidding. I was kidding.
I truly was kidding. But it is an issue that comes up. And when we say we recommend the kangaroo pocket, the reason we do that is because we have the only pre-opened, easy-to-fill pita pocket. In fact, we have a federal patent on it.
Oh, yeah. And I forgot to bring that up. You told me that once when we were talking. Explain that you don't make these and cut them. You actually produce them so that they have a natural pocket in them.
Well, all pita pockets, in truth, are supposed to have a pocket. The dough puffs open during the baking process, and it creates the pocket.
I see.
But the way pita bread is always packaged is the air is compressed out of the pocket, and they're packed 6 or whatever pieces in a bag, and they're compressed, and they stick together.
Right.
So the number one complaint that consumers will tell you with pita pockets is that the pockets are hard to open, and they often tear.
Yes, I agree. I mean, so I've had this problem a lot.
We thought, what if we could deliver the product in a form to the consumer that enables them to simply separate it and the pocket is already gapped open? And hence, we came up with the pre-open pita pocket. It was so unique, and it solved a major problem that the U.S. Patent Office agreed with it and granted us a U.S. patent.
Okay.
That is now our number one selling item. And we thought that if you're going to put people on a pocket diet, you need to make it easy and goof-proof for them. So our product was really the best product for the diet. And they're consistent. Each piece is consistent. It isn't misshapen or broken. And it holds the perfect 3 ounce of food, which is a perfect serving size for a variety of everyday foods.
Well, you're full of surprises.
Yeah, George, we're just absolutely delighted that we tripped over Kangaroo Brands.
Yeah, when, as I told you, we found it, our son and daughter-in-law found it in Greenwood, South Carolina.
So we're absolutely thrilled. And listeners, you got to get some of this stuff. George explained to you where you can get it if you have any difficulty.
I'm sure
there must be a website.
Hop on our website, and we have a store locator. You can email us, and we'll direct you to where you can get it.
Okay, and it's www.kangaroobrands.com.
Kangaroobrands.com.
Well, George, you are a delight, and keep us informed of new products. And I'm just flabbergasted that I thought that I didn't realize that you were the founder of this very, very popular diet, current diet, the pocket diet.
The third edition of this diet is coming out very soon, and it is it's a 275-page book with many, many more recipes in it than the first two editions.
I'll be darned. Well, now are you as rich as Dr. Atkins was?
No, I wish I were, but I'm alive.
That's true.
Yeah, well,
God rest his soul.
Thank you for joining us on the menu, George. It was a pleasure to talk to you.
And stay in touch.
You two are a delight.
George, thank you.
Have a great day.
You too. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Well, you know, people say often that they really envy us with all the wonderful food that we get to eat. I think that the most enviable aspect of what we do is the wonderful people and the grand conversations we have with these people because of the field. What do you say, Rabbit?
I think so. I mean, food restaurant people are great people. Wine people are great people. Specialty food product manufacturers seem to be fine people too, and it's really fascinating to have all the different versions of how a product came into existence, and to know that the good old American tradition of innovation is alive and well and happily existing in the food business. And now it's time to
take a break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back on the menu. Remember to email us at any time and at all times. That's what I started to say. On the menu at onthemenuradio.com. A question to ponder. Why are there so many wonderful women chocolatiers?
I really don't know. I guess maybe it's the same reason there are lots and lots of women pastry chefs.
Because they have that patience to deal with it all.
Patience and precision, I think. Now, I think it'd be fair to say we've had some pretty good male chocolate makers
like
on the program too. But on theme, of course, and always has that as a theme. On theme, the next segment of the program, we're going to give you the opportunity to listen to not one, but two lady chocolatiers. And here they come.
Lon Wong, you've had a very interesting career, actually, change of career. You are a co-founder of Petit Noir, which is a line of confections. You didn't start out doing this, did you?
No, I didn't. Actually, prior to this chocolate venture, I was in advertising.
Uh-huh.
And, I guess I should start further back because I was very much like yourselves, Anne and Peter, because I was the recipient of I loved tasting and eating all kinds of desserts and trying out new foods. And I mean, I used to be the kind of person who would read the dessert menu before actually reading the main menu because that determined what I was going to eat that evening.
Now you're contemplating here, and I'm gonna ask you, instead of contemplating, if you can speak up a little bit, that would be really good.
Oh, okay.
That's it. That's where we want to be.
Okay.
They talk quietly in Walla Walla, Washington.
Yes, a little bit, yes.
So you changed your career, but you also changed your location. It's a big jump from Manhattan to Walla Walla.
A huge jump. And I wouldn't have done this without my partner, actually, and my significant other, so to say, James Boulanger. He actually grew up in Walla Walla.
The family connection.
See, I wondered how you picked Walla Walla.
See, we used to say...
I didn't even know about Walla Walla when I was, you know, in New York.
No, I can understand that. Most people in New York wouldn't know where it is. They don't know it's on the Snake River. They don't know anything.
Yes.
Now, this is the opposite of Cher Cher La Femme. This is Cher Cher L'Homme.
Exactly. but James, unlike me, he's actually been in the culinary field a lot longer. He started out baking right after high school, and he's baked for some, you know, quite, you know, famous establishments like, you know, Sullivan Street Bakery and Amy's Bread in New York.
Oh, yeah, that's right. He was at Amy's. We know Amy. We love Amy, yeah.
So, but unlike him, I didn't start out that way. I was more sort of not really knowing exactly what I wanted to do, but I did find myself one day, you know, in the advertising industry feeling that this is not quite as fulfilling as I thought it would be. And I've always loved sweets, as I mentioned before, and I had lived in Paris for a period of time, and that's really where I sort of had my own, started sort of my own ideas of you know, it really formed what I really liked in terms of dessert making and chocolates and so forth. And I thought to myself, you know, why am I not the one creating, you know, these delicious creations? You know, it's great to be the recipient of them, but it would be great to actually make them. And that's sort of like how it started. And I did some research when I was in New York. I had looked, I basically went to all the chocolate shops in New York and pastry places, and I dragged my sister along with me, and there were often days we felt so sick because we had so many sweets that day. But I did find a small little chocolatier based out of Soho that I loved, and they were Maribel chocolates. I don't know if you have heard of them,
right.
But they make some beautiful chocolates, and I just fell in love with the place, and I basically begged the owner to see if, you know, she would, you know, hire me and take me in. And that's really how my career started, was by learning from her. I didn't go to any formal training, any formal school, so to say, but I did a lot, I learned a lot from my experience working at this chocolate place.
So you and James head out for Walla Walla, Washington, and then you start making chocolate. It's really simple. Now we should eliminate some confusion here, because the name sort of indicates something that had us confused, and we should clarify that, because the name of the company is Petit Noir, and it sounds like they ought to have a wine like Pinot Noir in them, but they don't have wine in them at all. So let's make sure listeners understand that completely. But that said, the flavors are rather unconventional.
Yeah, and
perhaps you can go on and a little further with that one.
Yes. Well, when we first moved here, we wanted to take advantage of the fact that this was a wine valley, the Walla Walla Valley, and we are actually on the Oregon side of the Walla Walla Valley. When we started out, we actually did a bit of research. We went to different wineries and we brought some chocolate over, and we even offered them a chocolate with wine in them. And we found out that some winemakers don't like the idea of mixing their wines in the chocolate, because they feel that their wine is the special creation that they've created. They don't mind pairing it with food, but not mingling, not mixing it together, so to say.
Oh,
and so we decided that we're not going to mix wine and chocolate together, perhaps only on special occasions if that's requested, but mostly we would focus on just creating chocolates that can pair with wine.
Well, can you give us an overview of your product line?
That is an overview of our product line. And so how we get our flavors is really very much what we taste in the wine. We we start off by tasting the wine, and we say to ourselves, what are we tasting in this wine? Are we tasting something floral? Are we tasting something earthy? Are we tasting something smoky? And that really sparks our imagination. And so if there's a wine out there that might have dark spice notes, that's probably where the clove came from. Or we even make a toasted anise. We even have a flavor that is an oak chestnut, where we use, like winemakers use oak chips, we use the same oak chips, and we flavor our cream with it, and then we add chestnut puree to that to really emphasize some of the woody notes. And so when you have that with the wine, you can really, it brings out a lot of the vanilla tones in the wines and so forth. So that's pretty much sort of like along the lines of what we do.
Now, what's this medjool bacon? Now, was that real bacon in there?
The bacon is actually just a little strip of bacon on the top, but the inside is medjool date.
Right, but that was bacon on the top, huh?
There is bacon on the top. And the medjool date is it's one of those, I guess, crazier flavors that we created for wines. I think we've had some, you know, there are some wines out there that have this strange description of bacon fat or leather, or and that's what that truffle was created for.
Okay, I'm looking at another package of what's called a mendiant. I must confess I'd never heard of a mendiant before, but I guess it's a kind of chocolate confection. And this has got fig.
It's a classic.
This has got fig. Well, it shows you I don't know much. It's got fig, pistachio, and fennel seeds. Mm-hmm. And the suggested pairing is Cabernet, Sauvignon, Merlot, or Syrah with an earthy character. So this is sort of the way you see it, huh?
Yes. The mendiant is quite a common, I guess, chocolate confection in France. Usually it's in a disc format with lots of dried fruits and nuts, but we've decided to sort of change the shape and make them into miniature bowls of fruit and nuts and some spices to go along. And we find that the dried fig really helps to sort of accentuate some of those fruity notes in the wine. And the fennel seed is nice because it adds just a hint of licorice into the whole palate. So it actually is quite nice. You might want to give it a try with some of the red wines you might have there in stash.
Well, we certainly do. Now we're having chicken tonight, so we're having white wine, so we probably can't pair chocolate there. But we'll make up for it sometime over the weekend.
Now, what about this durian fruit?
Oh, durian fruit is actually a tropical fruit.
I know what it is, but is there any real durian in there, or is it just
there?
Tastes
is
like
real
that?
Durian. There's a durian
really?
Puree.
I thought it was illegal to bring it in.
If it's actually in frozen format. I guess they call it freshly frozen, the durian fruit.
No, it's okay. Huh?
And so, yes, you are able to get some here in the States.
Well, this is an absolutely amazing.
Well, you can see how fascinated we are by this. We have 10 million questions we could run on about all these flavors.
This is an absolutely exciting adventure that you're engaged in. I hope you'll say hello to James for us. I hope you'll continue to be successful. And in closing, can you run through the options that people, listeners, will have to be able to obtain some of this gorgeous stuff?
Yes,
you can tell he likes this.
It's an excuse to eat chocolate.
Aside from coming to visit us at our shop in Milton Freewater, actually, which is on the Oregon side of the Walla Walla Valley, you can purchase our products online. The address is www.petitenoir.com. And Petit Noir is spelled PETITSNOIRS.
Right. And I do see here it's Milton Freewater, Oregon.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Maybe we'll come visit you, Lon.
Yes, please do.
And in the meantime, thank you so much for joining on the Menu Radio. It was a delight to talk to you.
So let Peter go back.
It was my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, well, Peter's going to get back to eating his chocolates now that we did the interview.
now I can demolish them at any speed that I like.
Thanks again, Lon.
Yeah, Lon, have a great day.
You too. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Now, Dufflet Rosenberg, your company is called, or your candy branch of your company is called Small Indulgences, but your operation is by no means small. You have an empire in the sweets category, and you've been doing this for 35 years?
Yes, almost.
How did you get into, you're called the Queen of Cake.
Yeah, part of the name of Queen of Cake is because our first store was on Queen Street. It's still there, and that's been there since 1982.
And it's a cafe or a bakery shop?
It's a combination of both. It's a cafe and retail store. We have one central bakery where we bake everything from, and then we ship to many wholesale accounts as well as to our own three retail stores.
Now, did we mention this is in Toronto, Canada? I can't remember if we did.
Not yet.
No, we didn't. It'd be a good idea to do that.
You have to come to Toronto.
It'd be a good idea to do that so that people don't get confused.
Yeah, listeners, this is all taking place in Toronto.
Yeah.
But the way we found Defla is that one of her products is up for a silver finalist and up for a gold in the Fancy Food Show this year in New York City. Are you going to come to the show?
Oh, of course, we have a booth there, yeah.
Oh, good. Well, I'll see you there, too.
Yeah.
Tell us about how is this all natural and pretty much artisanal almost, and when it's such a large operation?
Well, we've done a complete audit of all of our ingredients, and we're quite confident that everything is all natural. We've had to source quite a few things. We also have to make many of our base ingredients that we use in our product from scratch, because we can't necessarily find an all-natural product that's out there. So we're very careful about our purchasing.
But I did ask you, and then somehow I didn't get an answer to this, I think because Peter asked another question. How did you get into this business?
I started to sell to a cafe in Toronto many, many years ago that no longer is there, and they gave me pretty much a free rein to do whatever I wanted, and I came in with my three cakes that my mother taught me how to bake, and they liked them, and so I started to bake for them. And because of that, other restaurants and other stores started to come in. Were customers are there, and they saw them, and they liked them, and they asked me to do some work for them. We're very, very much organic.
Well, what drew you to pastry and candy making?
I love sweets. I've always liked sweets. I didn't have a lot of background in it when I started, other than eating everything that my mother made, but... So I was drawn to it because I thought I might want to do something in the food business. Gone to a normal cooking school where I realized I didn't like handling meats and vegetables on a daily basis. So I was very much interested in the butter, sugar, flour.
So you must have a little scientist in you as well.
But maybe a little bit, yeah.
The precision.
Because it's definitely a science. It's not like cooking at all. It's hard to improvise with desserts.
Now, I mean, you are known for your specialty cakes and wedding cakes in particular, and you have had some very famous customers. I noted Mick Jagger.
Mm-hmm.
And what kind of cake did you make for Mick Jagger?
It was a chocolate fudge cake.
So he likes chocolate.
I don't know if he actually ate the cake in the end. It was for his birthday celebration that was here in Toronto at one of the nightclubs, because they hear, I don't know if you know this, they do a lot of recording. There's a particular studio
like.
It's a little bit hidden away. I guess they can hide away and do their thing. And so they were in town for that.
And I also noticed you had a testimonial from one of my favorite authors, Margaret Atwood.
Mm-hmm. Well, Margaret Atwood's also a famous Torontonian who lives, you know, I've seen her on the she shops at the same flower store where we get our flowers for our wedding cakes. I see her around. She must live around that neighborhood. And she frequents many places in Toronto.
I'd love to meet her.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just absolutely dazzled by her books.
Yeah.
I think
yeah.
I've read every single one of them.
Yeah, she's a fantastic writer.
Yeah. Now, you've had other famous clients, I'm sure. I have an odd question.
Mm-hmm.
I have a friend who's is into specialty cakes and cupcakes and so forth and so on, and I see there is going to be an enormous niche developing that nobody's meeting with, like, same-sex marriage.
Yeah.
Do you
yeah.
get any kind of...
Well, as you know, Toronto was the first place where they legalized same-sex marriages in Canada, right? So we started that a few years ago when it became legal. And, you know, we have the little two grooms for the top of the cake. And, yeah, we've done quite a few.
Oh, that's
wonderful. We've done quite a few, yeah.
That's really amazing.
Yeah, a lot of the marriages, well, especially the same-sex ones, don't seem to have these huge 300-400 guest weddings. They tend to be smaller.
What is the most expensive cake you've ever made?
I mean, our cakes are quite affordable. I don't think we've ever made anything more than $1,000. Under a thousand for sure.
Because I mean, some of them are $10,000 cakes.
Oh, I know. They're very elaborate.
Yeah.
I think that our cakes are quite beautiful. They're very edible. They're meant to be served that day and enjoyed, or you know, keep the top tier and freeze it for your first anniversary, that sort of thing. But they're really meant to be eaten and enjoyed by everyone.
Tell us about Crackle. Oh, go ahead.
I was just going to move us towards, since it would be difficult for listeners who are not from Southern Canada to be able to get all these wonderful cakes. And it wasn't exactly a left turn to get into making these sweet indulgences, but tell us a little bit about those, because people can get those pretty much anywhere, I guess.
Yes. Well, we wanted to extend our brand and extend our brand beyond Toronto, and this seemed like a logical way of doing that, that we could take the feel and the flavor of what we do and put it into a box that had that could sit on a shelf and could be sold across, you know, the U.S. and Canada, and that's exactly what we've done.
Oh, it's delicious, by the way.
Yeah, everyone says it's quite addictive. And we have a new flavor. I think you saw you've had a sample of that as well, the caramel crackle.
You've probably, Duplett, watched this fancy food show grow and grow and grow.
Yeah, I started going a long time ago.
Yeah, what do you think? I mean, there are all these products.
Yeah. It's always funny to see when there's a trend, too. Like, every show there's something. Suddenly, for some reason, there's dozens of them. I remember, like, in the 80s, it was salsa.
It was what?
Salsa.
Salsa.
Salsa. Mustards, in the early 90s. It's just funny how the trends keep.
And what do you think
along.
It is now?
Well, there's definitely chocolate and bittersweet, the whole dark chocolate, antioxidant. Lots of teas, the green tea thing and the green. Everything sort of health-oriented, functional food-oriented.
Yes, exactly. That's what I think,
well,
too.
Last year there was a lot of organic starting to happen, too.
Let's go back to Crackle. What is Crackle an official word, or is it just a word you made up? I mean, it seems like brittle or like toffee. I mean, what makes a Crackle different?
It's not a brittle and it's not a toffee. Okay. So that's why we called it Crackle, because it's very different from those. I mean, the texture is much thinner. The way the nuts are cooked and everything, it's just not like speaking of toffee, there's been many toffees I've seen and tried.
Yes,
and I love all those, anything with brown sugar combinations like toffees and caramels.
Salted caramels is a big thing.
Yeah, salted caramel. But I'm a big nut fan, and we make quite a few of our desserts with nuts.
Uh-huh.
So we like to explore desserts with nuts.
Oh, that's great.
So it's really something that's very much about us, too. And the chocolate on that is bittersweet, but it's not like a super strong chocolate. It's not a 70%. I think that would overwhelm the product too much. It would take away from the nuts.
Right. We've had raw.
Oh, my gosh. You must have tried thousands of chocolate.
Right now we're tasting crackles alongside brittles alongside toffee. Our teeth are threatening to fall out.
Yes, no, that's the other thing about all this. It's not very good for your teeth.
Now, can we do a quick, how do you find out more about these wonderful Crackle products and where are they in distribution, that kind of thing?
Well, they are in distribution across the U.S. Unfortunately, we're not privy exactly to where they're sold because they go through brokers and distributors. So I will ask Heather to try to provide some key stores for you.
Well, but the website is a good place for our listeners to start, right?
Yes.
And that website is?
Duflet.com.
Spelled?
D-U-F-F-L-E-T.
.com.
Yeah. And that's if you click on Small Indulgence, you'll see more about our products.
Oh, there we go. So Small Indulgence is another way to find them.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it's on that website.
And undoubtedly, there'll be more products along the way.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And before we sign off, we should give our listeners a geography lesson for those people who have no idea where Toronto is and think it's a small village opposite Buffalo, New York. Give us an idea of the population of the Greater Toronto Metropolitan Area.
Oh, the Greater Toronto Area is over 4 million.
Uh-huh.
It's a big place.
So it's almost as big as Chicago, and equally as important, incidentally, if you're a travel person.
In the food business, absolutely. There's a very large food processing component of Toronto. Interestingly enough, lots of food processing happens in this area in the GTA. It's called the GTA, and it's very exciting. I think lots of great things come out of Toronto. We have wonderful chefs and wonderful food and
films.
Very diverse.
Lots of filming and recording.
Yeah, filming and recording and
great restaurants.
Yeah, great neighborhoods. In some ways, it is a little bit like Chicago in that way.
I was just
we have a very vital and lively downtown. There's a huge amount of condo development going on here now.
Yeah, you've sort of built a whole new Toronto between the railway station and the lake, right?
Which used to be all
food processing plants.
Yeah. Unfortunately, you know, it's too bad when you see all the manufacturing going away from the city, but it's being replaced by a lot of condominiums and soft industry. So.
And it's also the home of the world's longest street, incidentally, listeners. Peter knows all
the
good
trivia.
Oh, man, I'm a masterpiece of trivia. Deflette, thank you so much for joining us. A delight to talk to you, and we'll hope to see you in New York.
Okay, I'll have your booth number and visit you.
Okay, great. We'll look forward to seeing you.
Thank you. Bye.
Okay.
And once again, it's time to take a brief pause in our program.
And we'll talk to you again on the other side.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Well, here we are again. I might remind you again of the email address on the menu at On the Menu Radio. And we're going to turn our attention now to two cookbook authors who, I didn't plan this at all, they also happen to be two females. Listen while we
talk to
them.
I feel dominated today.
Well, no, you had the nice man from Kangaroo.
Oh, did I have some guys? I had some guys on the program to begin with. Thank goodness for that. I was feeling quite outnumbered.
You're masculine, and that's fine.
There we go. Okay.
So, we go to Zove and we go to Martha Foose. Let's run them together.
That's fine.
Yes. Welcome again, Zov Karamanian. I almost got that.
it's Zove, like in Jove, I guess.
Is it Zove?
Yeah. That's the official pronunciation, right, Zove?
Yes, it is Zove.
Zove. Zove, we're revisiting this book, but with a difference. We interviewed you somewhere around Mother's Day in 2005 when this book first... You first published it. It's a self-published book, and we talked about it then. And we just got a copy of the second printing of it. It's a popular book, is it not?
It's quite popular, only because the recipes are so easy to prepare. It is today's cuisine, the type of food that people want to cook and eat. It's very fresh. It doesn't have too many steps. It doesn't have too many ingredients. It's just basically ingredients that you have in your home. You don't have to go out and buy any specific things that are specialty items. So people really like that. It's very colorful. It's very healthy. Lots of grains and lots of vegetables and seafood and all of that.
Now, why is it subtitled Recipes and Memories from the Heart?
Yes. The subtitle is really collaboration of my recipes throughout my career, being in the restaurant business the last 21 years. And these are really recipes that are very close to my heart, and every recipe has a story to tell. And it just gets the cook into the story, and it just makes a difference.
Yeah, it's a good read.
Yes.
Yes.
It's a story, yes. It's about my experiences with food, my travels, my family. It's just really fun reading, like you said.
Right. Now, I mean, it's rather unusual, it's a phenomenon in the publishing world, to be able to self-publish this, go into a second printing, and sell as many copies. How many copies did you sell?
We sold about 15,000, and we printed 15,000 again, and it's doing phenomenally well. And a reason for the self-publishing was, you know, publishers want easy authors that they can sell the book. In other words, if you're on television, if you have your own television show, they know that it's going to sell well. But, you know, it doesn't always mean it's a good book.
Right.
So it was very hard for me to get a publisher to go with my idea. So I figured, you know what, I know in my heart that this is going to do very well, and it really has. You have to believe in yourself. And the only thing is, with publishing, you pay upfront if you self-publish it.
Oh, sure.
And you know what I'm saying.
Oh, yeah, it's taking a chance.
We were talking to a chef the other day who just produced his first book, and he wanted to self-publish, and then some publishers talked him out of it. but he says, I'm not making any money.
Exactly.
He said, I make dimes per copy. And if I had controlled it, I would have made a whole lot more money.
Right, right. And you know what? If you can allow yourself to go through the process, it's not easy to do the self-publishing, to be honest. You really have to have the passion, the fact that you really want to make this book. And when you do have that feeling, then when you believe in that, you will have a phenomenal book. Because my book is really beautiful. It's beautiful pictures. Every recipe has a picture, and most people really like to see the picture because you can't imagine what the final dish is going to look like unless you have a picture.
I can't believe that you made beef stew look good. I mean, that's very hard to photograph.
Oh yeah. Well, we had professional photographers that did the book. Like I said, you have to pay up front in order to get a good book. And that was the only, you know, it does get expensive, but, you know, if you can hang in there, it does pay at the end. And to me, it's not about the money, really. It's about having a great book out there.
Right. Now, let's remind our listeners that you're also in the restaurant and bakery business, so
yeah,
you're not just a cookbook author.
Exactly. We have 3 restaurants now. When we talked to you last, it was our original restaurant, Zoe's Bistro in Tustin. We now have 2 additional restaurants. One is in Newport Beach, in Newport Coast, and we have another one in Irvine.
Oh.
So they're doing very well as well.
And it can't possibly be all family operations.
It's all family operations.
Oh, it is?
Yes. My son and daughter are involved. My husband is involved as well.
Your mother?
So it's the only way in this country, in America, is, you know, to have a family that you can all grow together.
Right. Now, I wanted to ask you, you said there were changes. What are the differences?
The changes were some of the photographs were dated, so we changed those. We changed the look of some of the dishes, only because, as I said, dated. It's just like the fillers. You know, when you have a book, you have an extra page, you put a picture in there. The fillers are all different now. We have other pictures in there. So just the little things, and then, of course, added a couple of more recipes in there, some couple of sauces, and that's it. It's still a very beautiful book.
Oh, it is gorgeous. It really is.
Yeah.
And you're hitting right on the mark here with the theme, because people are so interested in Middle Eastern cuisine right now.
That's because a lot of people are traveling that part of the world, even though it's kind of dangerous, but there are some areas where they're not. And also, there's a lot of people from the Middle East that live in this country.
Mm-hmm.
And the food is really delicious.
It is good.
It's not typically a Middle Eastern cookbook, but since I'm Armenian, I'm from that part of the world, it has the flavors of that cuisine.
Well,
lots of grains and lots of salads and appetizers and things like that. I was in New York last week and had dinner at Milo's, and I'll tell you, that was one of the best Greek restaurants I've ever been.
Do you know what? Were you there for the Beard Awards?
Yes, I was.
Yeah, well, so were we.
Uh-huh.
And
what a great event, huh?
Oh, yeah, it was splendid.
It was.
Some of the final awards were a little bit problematic in my mind, but I'm not going to get into that.
Uh-huh.
But we were just talking about that restaurant, and everybody raves about that restaurant, and that's the one we went to, isn't it, Abbott?
It's a seafood restaurant.
It's called what? Milo's?
No, I think it's a different one.
It's a different one.
Oh, it's a different one.
Oh, okay.
I think Adam Platt just reviewed it, but it's a different than the one I was pointing out to you the other day.
Oh, okay. Because we went to one that everybody raved about and we didn't like it very much, but,
Well, it's subjective, right?
Well, I mean, it is, but I guess I feel like I know Greek food pretty well since I owned a Greek restaurant in Philadelphia.
This was a really terrific restaurant. The fish was unbelievable. They have, fresh fish flown in from the Mediterranean.
Uh-huh.
It's fantastic.
Wow. And we like Anthos, too.
Which one?
Anthos.
Anthos, yes, I've heard of that.
Michael Tsilakis, yeah.
Yes, right, I've heard of that.
Anyhow, well, so good luck with this.
Thank you.
New venture.
Thank you.
And also, you're so busy, I don't know how you've managed to fit all of this in, everything you do.
Well, Well, you know what? It's just a passion, and you just manage your time. It's all about time management. Priorities. You prioritize your day.
Uh-huh.
Just go that way and do the best that you can.
But I never get all that done that you get done. You're everywhere. So, well, anyhow, thank you for talking to us again.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, and
I'll see you in person sometime.
Well, yeah, we could have done that at the Beards, I guess.
That's right. I wish I had known you were there. We would look for
you.
Yeah,
we were in the press room. Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Okay, wonderful. Dear.
Well, thank you.
You have a good day. And
you bet. You too. Bye-bye.
All right. Thank you. Bye. Welcome, Martha Hall Foose. Your book is just delightful, Screen Doors and Sweet Tea, Recipes and Tales from a Southern Cook. Now, Martha, you are a cooking instructor, a food writer, a cookbook author, a cook, undoubtedly, and a world traveler.
And a mama.
And a mama.
And a survivor of 6 months or more. Nursing a broken foot, too, you just told us, and we are so sorry to hear that, but we're glad to hear that it's all coming back now.
Oh, I'm back in the kitchen with a vengeance.
Oh, that's great. And you also were right back where you started from. Tell us about where you are.
Well, I live right in the heart of the Mississippi Delta between two rivers, the Yazoo River and the Tallahatchie River, and we're about halfway between Memphis and New Orleans. And my town is called Thornton, but they took our zip code away because we didn't have enough people anymore.
Oh, my goodness. And you said it just drew you back, huh?
It did. It did. I was sitting in Minneapolis on Easter Sunday with like 2 feet of snow, and it was not right. I had to come back south.
And you're on the farm that your grandmother left you, hmm? Did you grow up there?
I did for up through elementary school, and it's always been home. We moved to Jackson where my father taught medical school for a while, but it's always been home base. It's called Pluto Plantation.
Pluto Plantation.
Now, is this your first book?
Yeah, I hope it won't be the last one, but it's definitely the first one.
No, you said you already told us off the air that you are working on another one already. So Anne only ever wrote one. And so she'd never ride a winner. Your experience must have been a little bit better.
Well, I think it's one of those things that if I'd known what I was getting myself into, I would have known better. But I think I've really gotten bitten by this writing bug, so I'm going to give it a whirl.
Yeah, it's unusual. I mean, you write so... I'm reading this book, and I'm totally immersed in the culture of the deep south Mississippi Delta. I should mention that you have recipes in this book. It's a book, of course, a cookbook with recipes and also with stories and with characters. Some of these recipes, and we've done a lot on Southern cooking, I've never ever encountered. Where did they come from and why are they so unique?
I think sort of the microcosm of the Mississippi Delta, it's really a unique sort of take on the South that I think a lot of people weren't really familiar with, because a lot of these small towns developed as river trading ports that you see a lot of immigrants coming up from New Orleans. And remarkably, in the Delta, we have a huge Lebanese population, a really big Chinese population, and a large Indian and Mexican population.
Oh, yeah, because you have some Mexican recipes in here.
We have a real melting pot, and it's as varied as a large port city is, but they're just little tiny versions of it all up and down the river.
So these recipes are not necessarily very old. They're not like recipes from New Orleans going back to the French roots or anything like that. They're more recent in their aegis.
Well, I think some of the dishes sort of, I guess if you ask people in the Delta, evolved on their way up the river, and if you ask people in New Orleans, they said they would devolved on their way up the river. It's a real cross-section. I think people have this idea in the South, we just sit on the porch and eat biscuits and fan ourselves, you know, 12 months out of the year. But, you know, we really do eat, traditionally we eat very locally. So the sort of local war movement is how we've always eaten down here, out of, you know, necessity a lot of times. And maybe everybody else is just catching on to that's what's good.
You know, sometimes reading these stories, like this mailbox happy hour or whatever it was, it seems to me to be, is it really still like that in the South? It seems so antiquated.
Well, one thing I think that's hard for people that haven't visited here, like I used to live in Los Angeles, and there you have entertainment thrust at you from every angle all the time. And here, we have to entertain each other. We have to make our own fun. And so I think we put a little more effort maybe into just thinking up hijinks and things to do.
Now, I was interested in the beginning of your book because I didn't think it was necessarily important to have a recipe for a Bloody Mary, but you say, I like to make Bloody Marys, but I like people to be able to manufacture them for themselves. And you had one secret which we learned here ourselves, because Anne's mother used to grow bushels and bushels and bushels of tomatoes and make tomato juice from it. And it really, you can't go back to V8 juice or Campbell's tomato juice after you've done that very easily because it tastes so delicious.
It's so delicious, and we're just coming that peak tomato season around here. And it's one of those things, it's so hard to have a Bloody Mary in the wintertime because you'll just remember how great that one you had in the middle of the summer was.
Well, see, that's when you freeze it. You freeze it in season and thaw it in the wintertime, and that's that. We used to get enough that we had a small quantity of that we kept. But the thing you added to the recipe, and I think these touches are all the way through the book, is to peel the ribs off the celery. If you insist on putting celery in, then you should peel the ribs off.
Well, that's what you're supposed to do.
Well, I didn't know that. I just cut it up and stick it in there.
Nobody looks flossing their teeth, no, and they take a bite out of it and have all the strings attached.
Oh, I see. Well, see, yep. Anne knew, and I didn't, because I guess I don't serve Bloody Marys with celery in many ways.
I think it's a thing that ladies are more concerned with than guys.
Is that what it is? Now, one thing we did get a suggestion on Bloody Marys that I'll give you, since you're trading such great secrets with us, and we learned this of all places in the U.S. Airways Club in Pittsburgh. It's that olives are really good in Bloody Marys.
I do, and I like to pour a little shot of olive juice.
So you already knew that. That wasn't even a secret, huh?
Well, it's a secret to some.
Well, listeners, the secret's out. It is an awfully good idea, and the little bit of olive juice adds something as well. And if you're like me, you have a cupboard full of about 40 different exotic pepper sauces that you can put in there, and I'm guessing that you probably do the same in your do-it-yourself Bloody Mary bar.
We do, and it's so funny. They seem to get hotter as the batches progress.
Yeah, I guess. And it's like you said that your accent got stronger the more bourbons you had.
My great aunt used to make these cheese straws that were so incredibly hot. And so you'd eat one of her cheese straws and then you'd drink some Bloody Mary thinking that was going to extinguish it. Uh-huh. But it just sort of built up the heat more and more.
You know, when we were talking before we got on air, I told you that your storytelling is just out of sight. It's so wonderful. But the characters, I just fell in love with your characters, and I would love to meet them. You know, it made me want to meet them, not just make the recipes. I love this mother of the church, Charlotte Miles.
Yes, and
she was not compelled. Tell us what that means.
Well, Charlotte Miles was this wonderful lady who lived in Yazoo City, and she was a mother of the church. And so I asked her, you know, what does being a mother of the church mean? And she said it meant you were not compelled. And I was like, well, what does that mean? And she said it meant you were not compelled to do anything. You're not compelled to feed the preacher. You're not compelled to have people over after a funeral because you'd done enough.
I think that's a wonderful concept.
But you had to do something first. You didn't become a mother by doing nothing.
No. Hopefully I aspire to have done enough good works to be not compelled.
There you go. You're hoping somebody's keeping the trapdoor open, huh?
Now, you also told us that sometimes that these recipes and stories evolve differently. Sometimes you thought of the person and then sought a recipe that matched that character. And sometimes you had the recipe and developed the story.
I think a good example of each way things kind of flipped back and forth is there was a wonderful woman from Belzona, Mississippi, named Ethel Wright Muhammad, who did beautiful embroidery work. And her story was so unique. She was the daughter of a Baptist preacher in a little town of Shaw, Mississippi. And a very handsome Syrian peddler kept calling on the bake shop where she worked and got to know her father and eventually asked for her hand in marriage. And her father, Elijah, said, you know, why should I let my daughter marry a Muslim man who can't read or write English? And he said, well, I can count all the money in the world. And so they got married and ran a beautiful little store together and had 8 children. And one of their sons went on to be Speaker of the House of Mississippi. Yeah. And when her husband died, she took up embroidery and would do it in the middle of the night to help with her insomnia. And her pictures are just so vibrant and gorgeous. And I was so moved by the whole story of her life. And I think it's something that, you know, you don't really expect to see coriander and cumin in a recipe from the Mississippi Delta, but it really reminds me so much of her. Each little grain of rice reminds me of her little stitches. And the exotic spices remind me of her relationship with her husband.
Now, what? This is the apricot rice salad recipe?
Yes.
Okay, there you go. Now, what about one going the other way?
One going the other way is there's a recipe in the book that's for silent shade cobbler. It's a blueberry cobbler that I named after a bridge. It's a wonderful little bridge that when they took the bridge out of commission, instead of tearing it down, they turned the bridge lengthwise down the river. And it always made me so mad that it was such a beautiful little bridge. And it was a drawbridge lowered by a mule at first and then a tractor later. And so I was making that cobbler, and I was thinking about blues because of the blueberries and what are the things that give me the blues. And that little bridge turned sideways gives me the blues. So
well, you know, I might add, since you brought it up, that there's so much color to what you name everything. The names you give things, like chicken pot pie with leftovers or from the top.
Well, there's a fabulous story on the second page of that. Did you see that about
her
son's first haircut?
Okay.
And when he went to the barber shop for the first time, he wondered where the rooster was.
he's a funny little character. His picture's on the orange swimming pool orange sherbet recipe, and every time he turns to that page, he says, oh, Mama, I have a brain freeze in that picture.
Okay.
What page is that one?
It's in the back. Let's see. It is 236.
Okay, and then along the way, listeners, just in case you think that this is kind of an oddball recipe book, everything you ever wanted to know about fixing gumbo, different varieties, is in there as well.
Yes, there are hints on every single recipe, which is great.
I must confess, what's filet, and why don't you put it in with okra? and probably knows what filet is. I don't.
Sure, I do.
I don't. Well, listeners might not know what's filet, and why are you not supposed to put that in as well as okra in your gumbo?
Excuse me, my dog's going crazy. well, filet is ground sassafras leaves, and sometimes you'll see sassafras powder in herb stores, but that's generally made from the roots.
Uh-huh.
And filet gets its name from what happens when you misuse it. If it's added to a boiling liquid, it forms these kind of mucilage sort of strands. And if you add it to a liquid while it's hot and just let it sit, it will thicken it. And okra kind of has the same effect.
Right.
I see. Yeah. So you
double up on all of it, then sometimes you can get more of a pond scummy type texture than a really great thick gumbo.
Well, let's go back over the details here. The book is called
Screen Doors and Sweet Tea.
There you go.
Which itself conveys the sort of comfy, nostalgic, down-home character of the book, I think. It's friendly.
And we got to get down there sometime.
I know. Come on down.
Yeah, you said we could come since I want to meet all these people. We can come to your family reunion. That would be great.
Well, we trade off mailbox happy hour with BB gun happy hour, where we put wine corks in the pond and shoot them with BB guns. So there's, you know, always something happening.
Hey, there's nothing but fun in the Mississippi Delta, huh?
Martha Hall Foos. Listeners can get this book right off of our website. And it's so much fun meeting you. I really enjoy you and the book. And I'm going to make frozen cucumbers.
And we're going to say goodbye now on the air. But would you stay on the line for just a second?
Sure. And it's been fun visiting with y'all.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.
And that, as they say in the business, is a wrap. Until next week, where we hope we'll see you same time, same place.
And it was nice visiting with you all, too.
There you go, and...
Bye-bye.